when you really look at what's happening on the ground, I don't think that we are really addressing these visions accordingly, because at the end of the day, it's about whose agenda it is and what do people want to achieve with their own agenda.
You are listening to In Pursuit of Development with Dan Banik.
Is global health truly global? And how diverse is the global health field? Global health organizations are mainly located in the global north, and experts from low and middle-income countries are still strongly underrepresented in global health leadership positions. Many of these global health organizations have also for long been reluctant to accept civil society or patient community representation on their boards. And even when they are a part of these organizations, representatives from many parts of the world do not necessarily enjoy decision-making powers. Even research on global health is typically dominated by researchers and institutions based in high-income countries. It is therefore unsurprising that there has been considerable criticism and often heated debates on who should represent the underrepresented. That is also the focus of our conversation today, and my guest argues that it is extremely important to ask who speaks for whom and about what. Professor Adris Malata is the Vice Chancellor of the Malawi University of Science and Technology, MUST. She trained to be a nurse and is former President of Africa Honor Society of Nursing and the former Vice President of the International Confederation of Midwives. Adris has previously served as principal of the University of Malawi's Kamuzu College of Nursing and is the recipient of numerous honors both at home and abroad. We discuss power imbalances in the global health domain, the importance of investing in the healthcare workforce and primary health infrastructure, and the major challenges facing the health sector in Malawi today. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
It's such a pleasure to have you here today, Adris. Welcome to my program.
Thank you.
Just a few years ago, there was quite a lot of talk about the Sustainable Development Goals, SDG 3 on health. In many parts of the world, there was this feeling that we all agree on the Sustainable Development Agenda, we're all going to push for this, and health is going to be very crucial going forward. Then we had the pandemic. And there was a lot of worry that in Africa, oh my God, you know, what will happen? It's going to be a disaster. And somehow it wasn't that bad. Many countries, including yours, actually did rather well. So let me start by asking you a very general question. How do you see global health today? Where do you think we are making progress? Where do you think there are major, major challenges that we should be addressing?
So that's a very interesting question, and I think maybe you're asking me this at the right time, because I think post-COVID-19, I think a lot has changed. And I want to say, maybe just going back, reflecting on what happened, I think we learned lessons. And I think we also saw a lot of innovation coming out of Africa or most of the low and medium income countries. I think something that people never expected. We saw a lot of, you know, creation of ideas, even ability of universities. So my university, Malawi University of Science and Technology, we saw students actually come up with hand washing machines that perhaps would have been thinking of buying as a nation, but we were able to produce it in our own university, manufacture, and then sell on the market. We saw a lot of innovations, not just in my own institution, but all over Africa and all over the world. I think a lesson to learn that I think no country should be underrated. And also the fact that we're also now looking into the future, thinking about maybe many things we can now do as nations, as countries on our own, without always necessarily, you know, depending on someone or some other entity that seems to know things better or have resources. However, I still want to challenge us, because I've seen that with global health, that we are still not moving as we should have done. And I think there's need to rethink global health. Global health, not by what we say in conferences and meetings, but what's happening on the ground. And are we giving ourselves an opportunity for those in low and medium income countries to be on that table, to be able to say, this is a priority in our nation, in our country, and this is how we want it to be done? I think we can't claim that we're doing well on global health if we are not able to get voices from the voiceless. And also the fact that the issue of power is about money, and those nations, those countries that don't have all the resources may have good ideas, but they may not be able to push their agenda because they don't have, you know, the power through money. And I want just to be very specific about money. I must also say that I think we still need to discuss decolonization. I think they're thinking, although in terms of discussion, a lot of discussion, conferences, meetings, but the reality on the ground is that we still use one language, we're still using the same approach, and as I said earlier on, getting people on that table, making sure that they're able to say what they think are priorities, and also making sure that we look at individual country visions. And so Malawi has Malawi 2063, Africa has Agenda 2063, the Africa we want, and we all look at the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. But when you really look at what's happening on the ground, I don't think that we are really addressing these visions accordingly, because at the end of the day, it's about whose agenda it is and what do people want to achieve with their own agenda.
One of the strong arguments in favor of the Sustainable Development Goals or the 2030 agenda was and has been that it was the most participatory process in the history of global goal setting. Unlike the Millennium Development Goals that were somehow drafted by some experts in the basement of the UN building in New York, the SDGs, it was a consultative process. Apparently a lot of people were consulted. So in that sense, there's been this projection that this is not something that rich countries or experts have done, but everybody has formulated. However, what you're pointing to is that really important question that is often overlooked about where are African countries in many of these agenda setting arenas? Why is the African Union left out in some of these big conferences and meetings with all the rich countries? So could you elaborate a bit more on what you think is not working? I mean, in terms of that agenda setting, how can African countries or Malawi or for that matter, any country in the world that is not sitting around the table, what are the channels do you think one should make available for those needs, for those demands to be articulated better?
Yeah, so I think when you look at what opportunities are there, I think maybe it is time now that people learn to listen, because I think these voices have been there. They've come out, people have spoken about the need to really have everybody on the table. It's not happening. It means someone is not listening. I think ability for those who make decisions and are in power to listen to the voices, because at the end of the day, we want to see an impact. We want to see a change. The people that really require these services or the care that we provide, whether it's in health, agriculture, climate issues, are people who always do not have an opportunity to go out to those large meetings. Their voices perhaps will never be heard by themselves. Someone has to speak for them. So creating an opportunity to listen, and then also not just listening, but also making sure that we really have that physical presence of those countries that can represent those that do not have a voice on the table. I think these issues need to be addressed. And I think ability for someone to take that bold step to say, well, we need these countries on the table and we want them on the table and not sitting on that table and we're determining what they will eat, to say, okay, here's a menu and this is what you should eat on this menu. No, allow them to say, okay, can we see the menu? and this is what we want to eat. In other words, they have priorities, and then you want to make sure that their priorities are met, and they should be able to articulate. I also think that even just for they themselves to articulate their issues rather than someone speaking on their behalf, because it's quite common that people think we can speak on behalf of these particular nations, but I think that the ability to say, okay, can you speak? What is it that you want and what are your priorities? And then people articulate rather than someone think, okay, we know their problems, who articulate on their behalf?
So these are some of the issues you and I have been discussing over the past few days in relation to research partnerships and how to make these partnerships more equal, or they should be based on equity at least, that it should not be a one-way process. Hearing you speak about this in terms of some of the voices that have been there, and you've been a very important voice for many, many years. You're a very inspiring person to very many people around the world. I wanted to ask you about the Malawian experience. If you hear today, Address could say, there are certain issues that I, Address Malata, would like to prioritize in the health sector in Malawi that I've been talking about for many years, but nobody's listening. What would those be? Is there something that comes to mind right away that you think an intervention that you really think should be there but is not being funded or prioritized?
Maybe sometimes people listen, but they don't listen well. So, okay. Or they listen and maybe they think there's nothing that can be done. I think I want to advocate today for health workforce. The issue of numbers, the issue of quality. We still need to train as many doctors, as many nurses, and I would say just any health workforce that's required to move a healthcare system, the issue of numbers. And so it's not just also about training or educating them, but when you educate them, can you give them jobs? And when they get into the system, can you retain them? Because remuneration is a big issue for health workers in Africa and many parts of the world. They are not well paid, they're overworked, they're overwhelmed with the work they do. I worked on the ward many years ago, and I know how tough it is for even a nurse, a midwife in a country like Malawi to work. Very, very difficult circumstances. Many times no resources, even just for them to do their work well. So I would like to speak that there's need to invest more in health workforce, investing in education, investing in career pathway, investing in retention. They want to send their children to school. They want to send their children not only to school, but also to a good school. And then they also want to have electricity, they want water, they want at least to have a basic good house, and even transport in a country like Malawi, where transport is a challenge. And I think there's need for more investment. And I want to say challenging, I think, nations, that every nation should invest. And yes, because nations are at different levels in terms of financial resources, that those countries or those institutions that are supporting healthcare should actually put resources adequate enough to train and retain them. I want to repeat, they are overworked, they are underpaid, the remuneration is not good enough, and yet we expect so much from them. I want to say COVID-19 taught me lessons. Mm. We lost so many health workers. They worked, even at the time everyone was afraid. These nurses, these doctors were on our wards in clinical settings, taking a risk, and some died. And I think for low and medium income countries, it's not just about COVID. It's been about many issues, illnesses, non-communicable diseases, communicable diseases, both now on the rise. So you're not, in the past, we'll be talking about communicable diseases, but now non-communicable diseases are also on the rise. Issues of cancer, hypertension, diabetes, all on the rise, and health workers have to deal with all these issues. I must also say that I think there's need to invest more in primary health care. I think if we can ensure that people don't get ill, don't get sick, we would actually be managing a bigger issue and perhaps making more inroads rather than just looking at issues of treatment. I want also to talk about another dimension. Is about many times when I've had an opportunity to speak about healthcare workforce, and I speak about education because that's what I did for many years and I continue to do. But usually people look at software. Okay, we'll give you scholarships, and yet the students need good laboratory setup. They need equipment. They need real infrastructure. And I noticed many times when I've lobbied, people will be saying, okay, we'll give you scholarships. Maybe we'll give you this opportunity for your academic members of staff to go to school. But they are not willing to build. And yet, you still need buildings. I mean, of course, now we are going virtual in many ways, but we still need a laboratory where a nursing student, a medical student, to be able to see. But also, for me now, in my new job, we are teaching medical engineers, we are teaching students who are learning about medical microbiology, virology. They need equipment, they need space, and even much more. I think, like for now, I'll give a good example of my university, where we have students there, we have male and female students. We are in a rural setting. I've been crying for extra hostels, and more particularly for girls. And when you reach out to partners, people seem not to move. They think it's okay. I think they can stay in that 20-bedded room. Yeah. It's all right. But I do think that I think there should be a change in the way we think, rethinking how do we invest in healthcare workforce, because this is a building block. You cannot talk about good healthcare without health workers, without nurses, without midwives, and making sure that they are also happy, because we talk about their behavior, their attitude, but many times don't talk about their own working experience, their own working environment, and then also how do you provide even a career pathway. If they do a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, what next? And can they still get into a PhD and then remain on the clinical side, like many countries do, I'm sure, even in this own country, in Australia, where I studied, where people can still go on a career pathway, still maintain their position in the world or in the clinical setting, because that's the only way you can actually balance quality of care. But in our settings, many times, is people get their PhD, they want to be in an office, and maybe we haven't provided a very good pathway where they can advance and still keep a clinical position. And these are things that perhaps people don't want to talk about, but they are a reality. And we also want to attract good students. So I've seen many students that have done maybe nursing and then they drop off and go into doing medicine. That should not be the case. You can do nursing, proceed with nursing, become a professor and still do other things, rather than thinking, okay, if I maintain a position in nursing, probably I will not be able to get into a job that will buy me a house. And we want to avoid that. So I think there's a lot of inequalities happening that need to be addressed. Because at the end of the day, it's about care. It's about quality of care. We need well-trained people that can also provide good care. And they should be maintained. The issue of maintenance is very important, because you see most of them then migrate into other countries, or they stay in country. There's internal migration. They go work for international organizations, non-government organizations. And then we leave those nurses who are, perhaps don't have another pathway on the ward. They may not even have passion for being on the ward. And it worries me. I think for me, it breaks my heart to see everybody leave when we could have kept some people on the ward.
I'm reminded of a friend of ours, Paul Farmer. He passed away earlier this year. What an amazing person. Life that was cut short too quickly. He inspired me a lot, and I'm so grateful for his friendship. Paul was very committed to, and he told me this many times, that what is important is precisely doing the so-called unsexy stuff, which is the training, the long-term investments in training doctors. And Partners in Health, of course, have been doing that. And it takes a long time to train, so you don't get that immediate effect, but training is important. But I also wanted to pick up on what you said about infrastructure. Because several years ago, I had the pleasure of visiting your university campus, MUST. What I was studying then, and I'm still studying, is, among other things, Chinese infrastructure building. And I think your former president recognized that, Bingu Mutharika, and he wanted a university that you currently head, where you could have first-rate labs, where you could actually have enough space, you could create a new community. And this was possible because, again, there was one actor, in this case China, that was willing to go beyond just the software and actually build the hardware. And China has been doing this in many parts of the world. What has been the impact of that? Say the university that was built, you have the labs. I know there've been some shortage of water and certain issues related to it being quite far away from the urban centers. But that kind of infrastructure is being built by the Chinese, right? Is that something that Western actors should be prioritizing more of? So in addition to giving money, in addition to helping with, say, the budget or budget support, which also Western actors actually don't do much of anyway, should there be much more investments in that kind of building, not just universities, but just health infrastructure in general?
Yeah, I think so. I think you've raised a very pertinent issue about infrastructure development. I do think that there's need to for all actors, so I would just say all actors, to really rethink issues of infrastructure development. Well, it is very expensive, but it makes a difference. And I'll give you, I think as you've rightly said, if you look at Malawi University of Science and Technology, it's one of the most beautiful entities in Africa for higher education. Actually, we call ourselves the warm heart for higher education. Very beautiful infrastructure, but I think as you rightly noted, there were some gaps. The university was built without laboratories, and there was no equipment as part of the whole grant, the whole loan. So issues of equipment, issues of infrastructure incomplete. We do have actually accommodation just for over 1,000 students, and yet the university should have a minimum of 5,000 students. So there were gaps, and we do not know what exactly happened, but those gaps need to be filled. So in other words, my message is, even for those who actually decide to support countries, whether through a grant or a loan, there should be completion of what was planned. Because if you look at my institution, we do not have even staff houses. So every member of staff has to get into MUST every morning. It's very tiring, all of us. So at the end of the day, one would think if you put an entity in such a rural setting, then you should make sure that you have at least housing, maybe a shop, good hospital. And we do have a hospital on campus, which is also empty. There was no equipment. I think it's now that the Chinese government is buying equipment. But I think my message is there should be investment in infrastructure. And I do know that perhaps there's an expectation for countries to do this on their own. But when you look at the levels of resources that countries have, not always enough to do that. And I do think that if you look at my country, perhaps we really haven't made so much progress on road infrastructure. And we see a few things happening now with quite a number of roads coming up. But it's, to me, it's late. And maybe because it's late, we need to run as a country that we do it, and not just doing it, but we do it well. So my thinking and my push, and that's what I advocate for, invest in both software and hardware.
One of the many issues I wanted to talk to you about, and this is something that I've heard now for many years, these figures that Malawi trains many nurses, but because of the salary issue, because of lack of opportunities, because of lack of accommodation, all these benefits that you were mentioning, many of them end up in the UK. Now, that kind of brain drain affects all countries that would face something similar, but it affects a country like Malawi even more.
You really can't stop brain drain. There will always be individuals that want to go to another country. But I think that then we need to train more. So those that are getting nurses out of Malawi should be able to invest back into Malawi. So we train more. But also, I've seen that if you look at the trend the last 2 decades, the numbers reduced. Okay. And what changed that was the fact that the career progression in Malawi was, we decided to put up a track that would ensure that nurses who had done their degrees, their diplomas, could be able to train in Malawi with at least master's level and PhD level. So for the first time, I trained in Malawi initially with a diploma and then degree and then an additional certificate in midwifery, then went to Australia, did my master's and PhD. But the lessons that I learned when I was studying in Australia was the fact that you really have to manage. You have family, you have children. I had to leave a two-year-old daughter with my husband and took a 10-month-old baby on the breast to Australia with me. One of the things that inspired me when I went back to Malawi to start postgraduate programs or graduate programs was the fact that I thought not every nurse should leave Malawi to do a PhD or a master's degree. And so at the Kamuzu College of Nursing, now we're part of Kamuzu University of Health Sciences, we launched 6 master's programs within 3 years and then PhD programs. And I want to appreciate here colleagues here in Norway that supported capacity building, because we sent a number of our faculty members here to study, but we were also supported in curriculum development and supporting what we initiated. But to me, when I look back, the multiplier effect. So we're able to train Malawian nurses at master's level, not only for the College of Nursing, but also for other colleges of nursing. We even trained people from other countries, Sierra Leone, I remember, Zambia, that came to study at our own university, then Kamuzu College of Nursing. I thought the career progression using education retained many nurses, because at that time, not many nurses wanted to go to the UK, because they knew going into the UK, they would not go in to work and then immediately start a master's program. But in Malawi, you were able to work and within 2 years, you could actually go into a master's program. So there was so much progress. And I must say that I can testify that career progression, it's not always about salaries, but if you give people an opportunity to do their master's program, PhD program within the country, then you can retain some of them. Now, I have, of course, seen over the past few years that that trajectory has changed again. I'm seeing quite a number of nurses now beginning to go back to the UK, and majority of them are not those that have done graduate studies. It's actually those that have just done the bachelor's degree. And mainly it's because of unemployment, because we have not been able to absorb everyone we've trained. And therefore, that pushes me to look at the issue of budget. As government puts up a budget, there should be resources for recruitment. Because I think the young nurses many times get frustrated. They would rather, you know, get out of Malawi, pick a job elsewhere, rather than sit at home and then they don't have a job. Because I think we're also like flooding the system. International organizations, non-government organizations can only absorb a certain number of nurses. So you see that quite a number of nurses have been sitting at home, sometimes even 3 years without getting a job. And therefore, we're now seeing, as I said, that the shift that some are leaving. And I know that because I still have to give references for a number of nurses that want to leave the country. So retention and then ability to recruit them when they have finished their studies and then give them a career pathway. You know, there are nurses that just are happy if they do a master's degree. They may not get as much money. Even they do a PhD program, they go through a PhD program, they graduate, they are within the system. And we also have seen some of them taking leadership positions because of their PhD qualifications.
Malawi and many other countries did far better during the pandemic than was expected. And there are all kinds of reasons. I've talked to many of your colleagues like Titus Divala and many others who pointed to the fact that, well, frankly, Malawi had quite a lot of experience with infectious diseases. Malawi has a young population. You know, there were lots of factors that helped Malawi actually succeed quite well in the first year. It was only during the second or third waves that things got pretty bad. So on the one hand, you have these successes that were perhaps seen by many in the West to be highly unlikely, but nonetheless successes. In terms of HIV, Malawi's often been hailed as a success story. Life expectancy at birth has increased for both men and women. Many of the Millennium Development Goals were reached. So you have those successes. And yet, we know there are many, many challenges. Informal sector, right? I mean, just how do you actually even enforce a quarantine when people have to go out to earn a living? You can't just stay in the luxury of their homes. And then, as you've already mentioned, the lack of adequate budget for health. Added to all of this is the whole the availability of drugs in the country and how difficult it is to procure. I actually have a project looking at how Indian companies are supplying drugs to Malawi and some of the challenges Malawi faces. So in a nutshell, how would you describe the health sector in Malawi today, both in terms of what is working and where you think there is a need for additional expertise, knowledge, but also finance?
The observations you've made are right. I do think that Malawi is an interesting country, because when you look at what's happened, well, we have tangible, you know, examples. So like how we have managed to really work on HIV and AIDS, prevention of mother to child transmission. I think we're one of the countries that made decisions and implemented what really worked for Malawi and then was used by many countries. I must also say, when you look at education, I think earlier on I was talking about the challenges about education, but I think we have made progress. I think for medicine, our program in Malawi is really an outstanding program. I think it's received a lot of, approvals. And of course, even people appreciating what Malawi has been able to produce, the graduates who are now mostly specialists and running the healthcare system in Malawi. And then, of course, nursing too. I think the College of Nursing was one of the largest in Africa, and also training people at different levels. I think you certainly very good examples there. I must also say that I think on the policy side, Malawi's health system, we've been able to develop policies for, you know, managing the different types of diseases, non-communicable diseases, communicable diseases, and I mean the whole spectrum. We've been able to do that very well as a nation. To me, what I see as a challenge is just that the issues are overwhelming. But you are right, COVID-19, we showed that it was possible to manage COVID-19. I think experience in infectious diseases helped the nation. I think third wave was just because the issue now was really just like too much for a country like Malawi with the numbers, and then migration, people returning to Malawi from other countries, and then of course the resources being very few because there was so much issues with the travel and flights into Malawi and out of Malawi. But I think we still did the best. I think if one documents the story about COVID-19, we would actually have a very good example. And then we saw innovations within in-country, as I said, universities coming up with innovations. I do think perhaps areas that we need to work on is manufacturing, because we are still buying nearly every drug. I mean, is it possible to manufacture some of the drugs in Malawi? And I think it can be done. I have a young scientist who trained in the UK, is back in Malawi at my university, and I know that he does a lot of work in issues of drugs and making tablets. So I've been discussing with him that, you know, I think it's high time we started manufacturing, even, you know, manufacturing, you know, equipment. MAST is actually offering a program in medical engineering, biomedical engineering. So medical devices, can we start manufacturing in Malawi? And I have already seen some devices in my university, and also the new MUBAS, which is used to be Polytechnic. At the moment, we are trying devices from other countries, but I have seen a lot of, you know, innovation coming out of our students, because we could actually come up with devices that we manufacture, starting with prototypes, and then, you know, then if we get approvals, we go into commercialization. I think it's high time our country went into manufacturing, because we are importing everything. And, you know, the forex is a big issue now. I think you have been following. So if we are buying everything, then certainly the country will struggle. But I think moving forward, and actually I have passion now that I'm leading a University of Science and Technology on medical devices, and I think that it can be done. I've seen what students are doing. If we can even just get one device done in Malawi and then we export, I think things would change. I've talked about the workforce quite a lot, but I also thought maybe we need to look at primary health care.
Yes.
And start reinvesting in primary health care. And so we take health care to the people much more than what we've done, because I think that we were pulling everyone. So I'm a maternal health expert. We are saying every woman should deliver in a ward, in a hospital. But when they come there, quality of care is a big challenge because the system doesn't have adequate space, doesn't have adequate equipment. And yet we could have actually allowed these women to deliver maybe in a healthcare facility that's smaller in a rural place in Malawi. But I have a very sad story, and that really has changed the way I think, because there was a time I was doing a study on why women died. And so I went out to rural Malawi. It was supported by World Bank. I had colleagues working with me from Johns Hopkins. We went out to rural Malawi, and this one particular story changed my life and changed the way I think, because we found a woman who was mourning her daughter. And she told us a story that her daughter was in labor. And she told me personally that she felt her daughter was healthy. She said she didn't have any issues. She was in labor. They went to a health facility, a small health facility in, I will not mention the district, but they waited for 3 days to get an ambulance when they noted that labor was prolonged. And then after 3 days, the ambulance came. They went into a district hospital. And then in that district hospital, the daughter died on arrival. Actually, she said, I was called in the labor ward, and I could see the baby still kicking. And I asked the nurses and doctors whether they could remove the baby, and they said they couldn't do anything at that point. So her daughter died. And so she posed the question to me that when her daughter died, within minutes, there was an ambulance to take them back to their village. And so she asked me, like, why is it that when my daughter was in labor, we waited for 3 days? When my daughter died, there was transport immediately. And I cried. I broke down because I felt in the 21st century that should not happen. So it means there are certain things that are not working well. So maybe we need to look at our referral system. We need to look at making sure there's transport. And of course, there will always be issues about maybe road infrastructure. But I think there's a lot happening now in terms of road infrastructure. But to me, I think ability for people to say there's an emergency here, let's drop everything. Let's get these people into a better facility and then a cesarean section. Cesarean birth is done if there's need for that. Rather than, you know, you're keeping someone for 3 days and then they die. And then when they die, you are saying here's transport. It left me with a lot of issues. And it's actually quite many years ago, but it's changed the way I think. Because I don't think that people have to get to that point where you don't provide quality care, quality services. And I have not still found an answer to that woman, because I thought that I left her without an answer. And so this question still rings. And to me, it's a wake-up call that maybe we need to look at our priorities, making sure that we have resources at every level of healthcare, not just at perhaps our tertiary institutions. With the tertiary institutions in Malawi, we haven't really grown. Like one central hospital in a region is not good enough. I do think that we need to expand that service, so it gets back to the issue of infrastructure. Can we have two central hospitals perhaps next to each other so that if one hospital is overwhelmed, another hospital can take care of that? And then the district hospitals, that we upgrade them, that they have every service that's required, and then we have specialists everywhere, because the specialist numbers are still low. So there's need to still train more specialists. But then the issue of equipment. Equipment is a big issue. Because even now as I speak, we have times when people go into a facility and then they just want to have, you know, perhaps check up. They want to perhaps have a biopsy taken, maybe suspected breast cancer. It takes weeks before people know whether they have breast cancer or not. I have a woman that I supported. She went in and we waited 6 weeks. And when she went back, third stage breast cancer. And she survived. But my thinking is that that should not be the case. Let's have diagnostic services. And I think if there's an area that needs investment, diagnostics. I'm not just talking about you go into Lilongwe or Blantyre and then you can go for this test. I'm saying, can we have diagnostic services in every district so that if people are suspicious, they can go in, but they don't have to give, you know, a specimen and then wait for weeks without knowing the outcome. And those who can afford will be able to fly into South Africa, fly into India, or they have an insurance. But a local individual who doesn't have any resource, chances are high that they will die quickly because they were not able to get that service.
You've raised so many interesting issues. Let me reflect on some of those because it relates directly to some of my current research projects. On the issue of procurement, which I alluded to earlier, there are certain bureaucratic hurdles, not just in Malawi, but also elsewhere. It is also related to the lack of foreign exchange. It has to do mainly also with how large the domestic market is. Manufacturing is something I hear a lot of African policymakers say they want, but when I talk to Chinese or Indian companies working in Malawi, working elsewhere on the African continent, they say it depends. Nigeria, Kenya, big market. South Africa, big market. Malawi is so small that local manufacturing is not viable. So yes, you could make paracetamol that some locals produce actually in Malawi, but for higher end products, for increasingly lifestyle diseases, etc., they're so expensive, but the market is so small, it is actually cheaper to produce in India, China, elsewhere, and then ship it than to produce. And the same thing actually goes for devices. But I like your point about how universities such as yours could actually play a very important role. And now, come to think of it, I used to read in The Nation, in The Daily Times, the two major newspapers in Malawi during the pandemic, how many of your students were actually very innovative, especially in relation to devising these hand wash machines, or it could be a simple bucket, right? Or a bit more advanced hand sanitizer dispensing machines. So there's certainly a lot of opportunity. But I wanted to get back to this issue of care. And a lot of my friends often jokingly, perhaps not so jokingly, say that we can be sick when we go into a hospital, but when we come out, we're even more sick. It's this kind of frustration with what is available. And it is not just the poor. It also affects the topmost politicians. It could affect the president, as was the case with former President Mutharika, who could not receive the kind of treatment he wanted because there was no equipment or something that was not available. And so a lot of the elites end up going to South Africa, to India. Medical tourism from Africa is increasing. And many Indian companies are actually making quite a lot of money because of medical tourism. So you see all of this happening. And yet there is, in my view, a lack of emphasis on doing the basics. There is a lack of emphasis on allocating enough resources for the preventive aspects. There's always this focus on the curative, right? So in terms of, say, the example of the woman you mentioned, it is very, very sad story that we sometimes are perhaps more efficient in areas where we should not be focusing that much on, right? Even though providing the ambulance to take the body home is an important part, but preventing that death from happening should have been the focus. But in your work and also in other works, I've read that some of the challenges in terms of maternal health relate to, of course, the delays in actually bringing a person to a healthcare worker's attention or to a hospital. There could be family-related issues. There could be the distance, as you said, infrastructure. So that's one set of issues. And then the second has to do with when you do come and there's an inadequate infrastructure, the hospitals. And so I've noticed that you've been, in your writings, been arguing about care and the different sort of ideas of care. Perhaps you could say a little bit about that kind of work. Where do you think we should be, not just doing more research on, but where should the money be provided. As you were saying earlier, it is in the rural healthcare centers, maybe not just in the urban centers. What else should we be thinking about? Because I'm told there are certain domains here, right? Could you highlight some of those important domains in relation to care as you see it?
It's also very critical to know that a lot has changed over the years. I think for me, when you look at the domains, the fact that when you look at the three delays about making a decision whether somebody should go to the hospital, I can now argue that I think if you go out into rural Malawi today, the chiefs, the community leaders have now understood the fact that a woman or a baby or any sick person should not be delayed because of perhaps their beliefs. Because there was always that belief that maybe before a woman is taken into the hospital, the uncle should say yes. It does happen here and there, but overall, I think there's a general understanding now that if people are not well, they need to get a service. And then also the fact that the health surveillance assistants who work in the rural areas are like providing some information to say maybe if this happens, this is what you're supposed to do. This is how we prevent cholera. This is how we prevent COVID. We have all these health workers that are working in the rural setting. I think the second delay is when they are in a facility, what happens. I think this is where we still need to push in more resources and more effort and perhaps even issues of policies. I think the systems are overwhelmed. That's still a big issue. There are a lot of number of patients that will be coming in, so the numbers are huge with limited resources. And so I went out to a facility a few months ago with a partner. We were working on family planning. And so we decided to go into Lilongwe, into one of the facilities, to look at women that had come that morning for family planning. I was shocked. The women were standing in the court, many of them waiting even just to be registered. So I asked the nurse, the midwife there, whether they could rethink the way they provide a service. Like, do all these women have to come at the same time? Perhaps women who are starting a service could come in the morning, and those that are going to coming in maybe for a refill or something come in the afternoon. So you don't see them, you know, like overcrowded like that. And she laughed about it. But I've been reflecting on the fact that maybe we need to change policies on the way we provide care. And so there might be need to look at some of our policies so that we decongest our systems.
Because it's not always about the money, is it?
No, it's not always about the money. It's about just looking at how a service is provided. And so in one of our studies, we are looking at, can we have women come at different times? So those who are coming for the first time, they come in the morning, and those that need to just come for a refill or perhaps to ask questions, they come in the afternoon, so that you don't have women standing in the court. So it's not always about money. And I want to also argue there that I think many times everybody pushes the issue of healthcare, the care, because of money. It's not always about money. Sometimes it's about policies. It's about, you know, leadership. I also believe that if you have a very good leader in a facility that's very progressive, that's transformational, they will change certain things. And you actually go into a facility and you can appreciate that, the fact that things are happening well. So I do believe that in the arguments in those of my papers, I think you've seen I've been pushing for leadership, transformational leadership, where as we train health workers and train anybody who is going to work in public service, we look at how can they make a difference in a setting by the way they think, the way they organize themselves, the way they do things, to make sure that also even the recipients of care will want to come back. Because there are times when people come into a facility and they're not happy with the service, they will not come back. And you find certain facilities are actually very busy. Other facilities nearby, not very busy, because people have gone, they're not satisfied with the care they receive, and then decide, okay, let me go elsewhere. So I do think there's need to have a policy shift on the way care is provided. Let's look at new innovations. Let's look at how we can ensure that we're giving care that is satisfying, and that our clients should be able to look back and say it was worthwhile going to that particular facility.
Because, you know, sometimes I feel that much of the care, not just in Malawi, but in many other countries, is characterized by arrogance. It's almost like you are supposed to be grateful.
Yes.
It's not your right.
Yeah.
We are being generous. Yeah. It's we are being benevolent. That's why you're getting in. And that's why you should wait for a long time outside the office because the doctor is too busy and there is no system. But in many other countries, there's much more use of, you know, mobile health, using the mobile phones, like in Kenya, to schedule an appointment. So there's technology available. A lot of people have mobile phones these days. So there's a different way of doing it. So I really sympathize with that argument you're making. Another example, not related to health, that I often, you know, think about every time I land in Chileca Airport in Blantyre. It's a small airport. And obviously, it would help to have a bigger airport. More money is required. But in the meantime, while one is waiting for a bigger airport, there are ways in which those rooms that are there could be better designed to make things more efficient. And I've been interacting with the Foreign Service, many of the civil servants. How do you design the luggage area or the visa section? You could free up a lot of space, make it more effective. And so I think those are just examples of how things can be done without really always thinking about the money. Yeah. But talking about the money, because some of these hospitals, address, are underfunded, I see a new trend in Malawi, because you have a growing middle class, or as you would say, elites. You either have poor and then you have the rich, well-off groups who actually get a monthly salary, work for international organizations, donors, etc. They are now able to access a different sort of health in some of the hospitals. So you have the free service, and then you can actually pay for certain things. Am I not right? That there's like a two-track option. So you could actually buy yourself better healthcare, skip the queue if you have money.
Yeah, it does happen, but I must say here, Dan, that it's illegal. It's not right. And it's unfortunate that it happens. And I do know that many times when people have flagged this issue up, there's usually, you know, like some feedback from those in authority to say this is not right. So, for example, if a lift is not working and then people want to be moved to third level, fourth level, then they pay to some people to carry them there. But I must say overall that some of the illegal practices, people know, and then I think they've been condemned. But also I must say that this is something that we need to discourage, because then the gap between the poor and the rich widens. I would rather we improve the service so that we get as many people to get quality of care. And I also believe that I think every individual needs to feel uncomfortable when such things are happening. I think we should not tolerate, because if we tolerate these behaviors, we are actually damaging our nation, and not just for now, but also for the future. And then the young people of Malawi will think that's normal. It is not normal. It's not right. Everyone should receive the type of care that's available. So if anything, we need to work on improving the quality of care so that everybody should feel comfortable to go into any facility and be aware that they'll be able to get good care. I want to give you an example here. So I lost an in-law a couple of months ago. We could have taken him to a paying facility, but we took him to a non-paying facility in Lilongwe. I was very impressed. Despite the fact that there was inadequate space, inadequate equipment, but I'm really impressed with what the nurses and doctors were able to do with their limited resources. And I said to myself, I wish we invested more in these facilities, because, we lost him because, things were just beyond what the hospital could do. But I wouldn't complain that he did not get good care. And that's what you want to see. Actually, I'm sure people were surprised that he actually died in that hospital, because they thought perhaps we could have put him in another hospital. But I must confess here that I was just impressed with even the speed and the decision-making and ability for doctors to say, let's try this, let's do this, let's do that. And that's what we want to see for every Malawian.
I think that's a very good point, because I think we have to have hospitals where leaders feel that they can get good treatment.
Yeah.
And citizens should actually see their leaders getting treatment in that hospital, yeah, so that they know that these leaders are not going to go to South Africa or India or somewhere else.
Mm.
Or like, you know, Robert Mugabe, he would never really get treatment in Zimbabwe. He was always going to Singapore. Mm. And that does not create much trust in the local system. But is it a case that in countries like Malawi, is it the government not prioritizing enough, not providing money? Is it, or is it that they want to provide money but they don't have enough?
I think they are competing priorities, because, you know, agriculture is a big issue for Malawi. We are, you know, dependent on our maize and tobacco and other things. So education is another priority for Malawi, and we have a huge, you know, educational system with primary, secondary, higher education, now TVET. So the demands are huge.
Yes.
And then you look at health, another big issue. We are dealing with two entities of healthcare. We are looking at infectious diseases, non-infectious diseases, and then, of course, something like COVID comes on board at a time you're not expecting. I sympathize with government, because I think the resources are not adequate. But at the same time, government has to move and things have to change for every sector. But to me, sometimes I just look at this is like you're looking at a young person who is carrying a very big basket on their head, and you can see them struggle to walk. Not because they don't want to walk, but I think the issues are they're just too much. I think Malawi has got very comprehensive issues to do with, comprehensive, but also it's quite overwhelming. But I also believe that there has to be, you know, that desire from every sector, whether it's our leaders, political leaders, or non-political leaders, and everybody just being on board and making the decision, let's see things change. And so it means really tackling every issue that would ensure that resources are used, they're used rightly, and that there's good apportioning of resources. And then for those partners that support our country, to look at how Malawi is struggling and how we are trying to deal with issues, and to say, look, maybe this sector, we can support you. I do know, of course, that they would always look at accountability issues, which is normal. But I think that willingness on part of those in leadership, those who are not in leadership, every citizen to really just say we want to see things change. I think for countries like your own country to be where you are, it took decades. And therefore, it might also be important that people should be patient sometimes to say, okay, look, maybe this particular project did not go very well. What do we need to change? Can we reflect openly to say, this you did not do well, this you did well, and maybe hear ourselves what were issues, and then to say, okay, moving forward, can we do this? Maybe shift the way this thing is done so that we can actually see a positive movement.
Well, I totally agree with you. Patience is important. The long term is important. And these are things that you and I were talking about, as you mentioned a few days ago. These are the messages we have for the Research Council of Norway. These are the messages we have for the Norwegian government, as we have for anybody really listening. I want to ask you one final set of questions, Adris. This relates to your personal career, your meteoric rise, your success as a pioneer, you being the first of many things, in terms of having leadership positions, heading universities, and often being the only woman perhaps in the room. Usually these rooms in Malawi, as in many other parts of the world, are full of males. How would you characterize that journey so far of your academic career, your leadership positions, your international honors, your honorary doctorates, your ability to work, as you said, with many regimes in Malawi? What has been the experience so far, and where do you see improvement in terms of getting a better, more balanced, gendered workplace? Because it is still a big challenge, isn't it, in Malawi, to actually get women up to the level that you are in. We need many more Adris Malatas.
Yeah, so my journey has been both inspiring but also challenging. I think, challenging, because indeed when you are first, then you have to really, you know, clear everything on the pathway. Actually, I normally laugh that even today, if I left my position, probably many more people will apply, because I think starting a university from point zero, three programs, today we have close to 40 programs, and then PhD holders, three, and now we have over 50 PhD holders. The same in my previous job in the College of Nursing, very few PhD holders at the beginning. I left the College of Nursing with 60 PhD holders. And so I've seen, you know, the power of starting things. It's very challenging. It also challenges the way you think. I think I have had to learn to be innovative, but also to rely on networks and partnerships and really get sometimes things done quickly. I think University of Oslo, we send like six nurses here, and today they're in leadership in Malawi. I also believe that as women, we do double what perhaps men would do. And then you are leading in that boardroom. So I've also had opportunities to be on different boards, both national and regional, as well as international board. Actually, I want to share an experience where I was the first midwife from Africa, actually, to become vice president of the International Confederation of Midwives. So they vote for you. I think it was in a European country. Mm-hmm. I'm there and I'm seeing the electronic voting. There was so much jubilation amongst midwives in Africa. And so for me, then the question you are raising is, I do believe that we should have many adresparators in the pipeline, so that when I'm not there, somebody should be able to take the position and do the work maybe much better than I did, which I think is a challenge. So Malawi has made progress. I think when you look at Malawi now, most of the senior positions, so like in the police, ACB, ombudsman, female.
You have Marta, but, you yes, have Grace, yes, you have all of
yes,
these.
All these people that have taken leadership. And then we have Dorothy at Malawi National Examination Board. But the question is, when they have finished their work, would we be able to have another woman take that position? We should also create an opportunity for women to start growing even much, much earlier in their lives. And because we, some of us were mentored by perhaps external partners. Professor Johan Asunbe from here, University of Oslo, took me by the hand. And I remember when she first met me, she said, look, I'm a very seasoned professor, so I don't necessarily need papers, but I want you to become a professor. And she managed to do that. So I was actually mentored by her. And she's not even a nurse, she's an obstetrician. So we need to have that, you know, not just, it's beyond mentorship, an opportunity to create this pipeline. And the pipeline should not start at higher education. It should start at pre-primary, primary education, secondary education, higher education. Although I celebrate this women leadership in Malawi, but the lesson about ICM, where when I left, it was taken back to Europe, gave me, I think some lessons about, it should have been a case where when I finished my term, another African midwife should have taken over, or somebody from Asia should have taken over immediately. So the pipeline issue is a big issue. But I also want to say that it's also about investment. So we need to invest in girl education, not just about girls starting school, yeah, but maintaining them in school. Because in Malawi, when you look at our data, they start well, but in higher primary, they drop off because they now become, you know, adolescents, and then the facilities are not good enough. So they will skip days when they're in a menstruation. Already they are losing time to learn. And then, so when you see that pool going into secondary school, the numbers are already getting lower. And it's so thin when it comes to higher education. Number two, it's also about making sure that fees are paid for. And so I'm one of those people, if you look at what I do in Malawi, is I've run for fees. There's no bank that doesn't know me. I've been to every sector, insurance companies, to plead for fees. Because if this girl is coming from a rural setting, no one is there to pay fees for them. When they come in, chances are high they'll get married to another male student who is well off. And then if that doesn't happen, sometimes they'll just drop off, they don't come back. But it's also, I'm an African woman, balancing, you are a wife, you are a mother, you are a daughter, You are a sister. You are a community leader. I do a lot of preaching in churches. So how do I balance? And many times that's the question I get. How have you managed? Because it's been years of leading, but I do have a very satisfying marriage. A husband who sometimes will even ask me, there's this opportunity, why are you not trying it? Or sometimes I'm asked to serve on a board, and then he says, oh, this is a good exercise. I don't know about this particular. He says, no, you have to learn. You have to do a course in banking for, you know, like finance for non-finance managers, because you can't sit on this board without understanding these issues. So if you have a partner like my husband, who is very supportive, it helps. But then there are other partners who don't support. So I need to help these women understand that you may not have a good partner, but this is how you navigate the journey. So in the healthcare system, that's other plea. Reason why we started graduate programs for nurses, master's, PhD, was I do think that the nurses and midwives in Malawi are very intelligent, very capable. And I would want to see them still occupy positions. So we have like director for HIV, director for sexual and reproductive health. They're all nurses. So I do believe that the heartbeat for healthcare in any country is nurses and midwives. So can they be on the table? But then for the same time, for any socioeconomic development, give them an opportunity. Women will always make a difference because they don't think about themselves. They want to leave a legacy. Like in what I do myself, I've dedicated my life to make a difference. So when I'm not there, I don't want people to remember me as vice chancellor, first woman vice chancellor, or first whatever. I want people to say, this is a difference she made.
Address, it was such a pleasure to have you visit my home today.
Thank you.
I know that I had a great time chatting with you, but my family also enjoyed very much meeting you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on my program.
It's really been a pleasure, and thank you for inviting me to be on this program.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please spread the news among friends and colleagues and share the link to the podcast on social media. You can tag us on Twitter at GlobalDevPod and Dan Bannick.
Thank you for listening to In Pursuit of Development with Professor Dan Bannick from the University of Oslo Center for Development and the Environment. Please email your questions, comments, and suggestions to inpursuitofdevelopment@gmail.com.